And I'm Alpha Evans, and I'm from Strawberry Point, Iowa. And we have a little slogan outside of town that says, "A town as good as its name." And it really is. It was named for a point of land that early settlers and travelers used to stop by and eat wild strawberries. Now, I'm not at all sure that you people know what Earth Watch is, do you? And do you know anything at all about the Maya culture?
Yes,
a little bit, okay.
I'm not familiar what Earth Watch means.
You're interested in what Earth Watch means? Earth Watch is a non-profit organization, and I've belonged to it for many years. You pay $25 for a membership, and then every few months you get a magazine that has in it opportunities for volunteer work in a variety of areas, usually in the area of archaeology or paleontology or mammalology or ethnobotany, something related to life, either life in the past or life at the present. And so these particular projects are listed, and you have an opportunity to volunteer to be part of the work that goes on those projects. Now, the sticker is that you have to donate money to the project. I have belonged, as I told you, for many years, but I have really only gone on two of their projects, and they were very rewarding to me. The first one that I went on was to Copan. And I will tell you about Copan when we get there. I paid $1,200 to go, and that I contributed to the research with my $1,200. I paid my own way to the site at Copan. And it was my privilege then to work with the archaeology people that were there on the site and were responsible for the project. And the only qualification that I had to have was that I was in good health and that I had some kind of skill that they could use. Now, when I was at Copan, I did some writing for them, some photography, but mostly I did grunt work. You know what I mean by grunt work? I did the kind of work that takes muscle, you see. They tell you to do it, and so you do it. And had a great time because it exposed you to a line of work that you'd always been interested in, and it allowed you to mingle with people who had expertise in the area. And I was very fortunate in the work that I did at Copan because I worked under one of the fine archaeologists, Maya people of his time. How many of you take the National Geographic? Okay, in the October 1989, there was a report on the work that Bill Fash had done at Copan. And that was just a year after I was there. We were tunneling into a mound at that time. And he kept saying, telling those of us who were volunteers and his workmen, he kept saying, "I think we're onto something here." And in this National Geographic article, he tells about having reached this tomb that he knew was in there with marvelous jade objects. You would be interested in that. Bill Fash also, he was our chief investigator, wrote the article in here called Scribes, Warriors, and Kings. And that was about the Copan project. Now, there are other nonprofit organizations that you can apply to go on projects like this. You see, you really can't get much of a vacation for $2,000, can you? Not much. And you'll get about 9 days when you're in a herd of people, and the projects last from 12 to 14 days, sometimes up as much as 18 days. And my transportation to the site was, I think, $550. So I invested $1,750 and had a fine time taking cold showers and working with the people on the Copan project. The second project that I worked on was at Yarumela, and that was also in Honduras, and that was just a new site that was opening up. And I don't know whether you looked at the board up there. Did you see that pink piece of pottery that I had stuck up there? That was one that I dug out. I dug out as we were excavating toward a stairway. And it was a large piece, comparatively large, about so. And I said, I think I've really found something this time. And the young man who was supervising our little group had heard that before, you know. He came down and he said, "That's significant. That's significant," he said. And so he took it very carefully up to the chief investigator on the project, and he agreed it was significant. And they dated it out to 550 BC. So you see, that was an exciting thing. You don't get that kind of things on paid vacations where you go as part of a large group. So I wanted you to know about Earthwatch. It's very worthwhile. There's also the Archaeology Institute of America. And I have some others listed here. If you're interested in that kind of thing, age is no barrier.
Do you have the handout on that too or not?
I wish I did. Mm-hmm. You know, I laid it out. I laid out my notebook. You see, you can read their magazine, and then if you want to have a briefing, you send off, with another little check for $25, you send off for a briefing. And then you get this notebook that tells all about the project. That's on my kitchen table, Ralph, at home, where I walked out the door.
What's the name of the magazine, Earthwatch?
Earthwatch magazine, right. And your money is going to a wonderful cause, you see. Well, anyway, you get this briefing and you read it. And when I read about Copan, it told about snakes and it told about all these other things that you had to have certain shots to go there. And all like that. That's no problem. And so I did all those things and away I went and had a fine time. Now, if you didn't like that briefing, you still had invested $25 in the briefing. But if you decided to go, that $25 applied to the amount of money you gave to the project. Now, at the Copan project, there was a forester from Oregon who was 75 years old. There was a retired Methodist minister from New York, and he had retired at, I think he was 68 or so. There was a young doctor from California. She was probably about 35. There was a lawyer from New York, a woman lawyer from New York, and she was in her 30s. We had a retired Spanish teacher. So you have a great age range, and you have a broad spectrum of occupation. So in addition to being in a place you want to be doing something you always wanted to do, you have this wonderful opportunity to interact with a very interesting group of people, because there just aren't any duds that turn up on something like that, you see. There are all kind of crazy people that want to do that kind of work. So it's great fun to be involved in that kind of project. Yes, I have the address. And anybody thinks they'd like to do it, remember, age is no barrier. They give you something to do, you can do. If you can't lift these big rocks, well, you don't have to lift those big rocks. They let you sort little rocks. Now, if you don't know, how many of you know about the Maya? One knows about the Maya, okay. The Maya were an ancient culture, and I put up a map here. We have a way of referring to these marvelous New World cultures that were here when Columbus came. This much of Mexico, ooh, this is going to make me dizzy, clear over to here, it was called Mesoamerica. And this whole area had in it developed civilizations that were as complicated and as sophisticated as the ones in Europe at the same time. They had a calendar system that was accurate, just as accurate as ours. They had a writing system that allowed them to communicate in writing, and also a spoken language that they could communicate in. They had a stratified society. They had a mathematical system. They had a body of astronomy. You see, it was high civilization that was here. And it began with early hunters and gatherers way back in the years before Christ. Now, the Maya that we're going to talk about here, the oldest roots they have found for them go back to 1500 BC in this area right here. This is what used to be British Honduras, and it is now called Belize. But they have recently found roots of this culture here, that far back. Now, we know about the Aztecs, don't we? How many know about the Aztecs? See, we got a few more hands on the Aztecs. And the Inca. Right. And the reason that you know about them probably is that they're closer to you in time. You see, they were late comers to this New World civilization bit. Not only that, they didn't last very long. The Maya went way back to 1500. They developed their village cultures into city-states. They rose and flourished and diminished and fell. You see, that's happened all through the world. That's a cycle. The cycle of civilization, it seems it rises, it develops, it flourishes, and for some reason or other, it diminishes and meets its end, you see. Well, the Maya, the last Maya stronghold, was defeated by the Spanish in 1697. Now you add 1500 to 1697, and you've got 3,000 years, haven't you? So this Maya culture, from its very beginning to the very end of the last Maya stronghold, spanned a time of 3,000 years. So, it's quite something to think about a civilization that has lasted that long when we're only how old? 200? About 200. Of course, we're all Europeans, really, aren't we? And our roots go back farther than that. But the Maya people endured for a long time, and we respect them for that. They had many practices that we probably don't approve of, and I can remember coming home after I had been out working in a place where I knew human sacrifice was made. And just this morning, you read about in Ezekiel,
yes,
about human sacrifice. And I would come home and I'd think, I got to read that New Testament, the Old Testament again. And because I think they did it too. See, so while that is hard for us to understand, it was a part of their culture. The Maya were not quite as bloodthirsty as the Aztecs, but they were not little peace-loving people. I'm going to give you a map here of the Maya area. Why don't you just pass them down? I think that's enough. And then just the ones you have left over, leave them on the end. I think I need one so I know what I'm talking about. There's enough for everybody to have one. And what you're holding in your hand is the Maya world right here. And it's this little sweep that comes down right through here. The Yucatan Peninsula, all of Guatemala, a part of Mexico over here, and a little slice of Honduras and El Salvador. This is the Maya world. Now, contemporary with these people, in other words, existing alongside them were civilizations up here. Not the Aztec, they came along much later. But you had the Olmec up here, the Teotihuacan, the classic Veracruz. You had the Toltec up in here. Now, they were all existing at the same time, but they all died out before the Maya did. They traded together, back and forth. One of the theories of the Maya's long endurance there as a civilization is that they were adaptable people and they were good borrowers. They borrowed good ideas from the people around them. Okay, now on your map, wherever you see a little dot, that's a Maya city. Now, wherever you see a little flat pyramid, and it may be a little hard to see under this light, and I think I chose my map poorly. Wherever you see a little flat pyramid, you have a major city-state. One of those major city-states is just about a little bit right of center, and it's called Tikal, and I put a little circle around it there. You see it? T-I-K-A-L. A little bit right of center. Tikal was a major city-state. Now go way down toward Honduras. In other words, go way down in here. And you should find another circle, and you should find Copan. You see it down there? That central area going through there is part lowland and part medium-high land, not real high mountains. But Tikal stands at about 600 feet altitude in a swamp. Copan is in a river valley. You see a little snaky river coming up there? That's the Copan River. And the Copan River joins to the Motagua there. So that's where we're going to be, right there, just inside the border of Honduras. In Copan. Now, Copan, really there are about three pieces to the site. It's a large site. Tikal was a large site. I wish you'd go up to the Yucatan Peninsula there. And you find a little squashed pyramid up there that says Ibish El Tun begins with D, way up at the top. Find that one? Mm-hmm. That was a major Maya city. Come down a little bit farther and go to the right and you should find Chichen Itza. You see it over there? Mm-hmm. That was another major city. Go a little bit farther to the right and you find Coba. You see that one? Mm-hmm. That was another major city. Now come back down into the central area and go a little bit left of center and you should find Palenque. You see it? That's another major Maya city. Now, all those other little black dots in there are also Maya cities. But they were minor cities. Just as in our civilization, we have cities that develop into big cities, and we have small ones. And the reason usually has something to do with the location. Is it on a trade route? Is there a river? Is there a way to get things transported back and forth? Are there valuable natural resources there? So what those big city-states did was form kind of nucleus groups with many smaller Maya cities. In other words, the smaller ones allied themselves with the big ones. And you know why they did. Why would they have done it?
Protection,
right. Protection. Now these are all Maya people. But World War II, we were all Caucasians too, and we fought the Germans, people just like us, you see. Our roots over there, that didn't make any difference. Here, these people are all Maya. But everything is just always copacetic here, you see. They become rivals in trade. They become rivals just to be the big man, you see, for power, just like it is today, that quest for power. So the small cities allied themselves with the big cities. Now the big cities, once in a while, fought together. In fact, find Quirigua, that's just north of Copan. Do you see it there? It begins with a Q, strange spelling. pronounced Pirigua. There was great rivalry between those two. And eventually, the ruler of Quirigua captured the ruler of Copan, decapitated him, sacrificed him. You see? So there was rivalry there among the big city-states. There was also cooperation many times. They would get along through diplomatic means sometimes, and sometimes they'd spill over and fuss at one another just like we do. Now, do you understand about the organization here? We have big city-states, and then we have these big city-states forming clusters with the small city-states. And Copan was a very influential and powerful city-state. Now, what's it like there in that valley? The valley of the Copan River, when you see it, it's very fertile. There's flat, fertile land there. And then you see the hills coming up, and you see wooded hillsides. But you can see that they had agricultural advantage there in Copan. And until their population outgrew it, you see, they could feed everybody. But over the years, the demographics got them. The population grew faster than they could figure out how to get everybody fed. So they had to go outside their own borders and trade for food, you know, import the food and leave products over there. Well, those people didn't want all those Copan products. So eventually, this was one of the things that figured into the disintegration of their society. Another was that more and more demands were made on the people. You don't build the big things that I'm going to show you on these slides without lots of manpower. Lots of manpower. And those demands were made on the people, you see. And that didn't always work so well. And then there are these neighbors up to the north, you know, who now see that Copan is getting weaker along about 900. And so they come down and grab a slice. Now the interesting thing about the Maya world is that they all grew up at about the same time, these city-states. And whatever held them together also fell apart at about the same time. Because those big squashed pyramid places that you see almost all declined in the year 900. And they're still searching for the real reason. But they think that they're going to find it now that they have figured out how to read all the glyphs that the Maya left as their records. So, it's an interesting situation. This is the site itself. And I hope you can see this. It runs north and south. I'm going to show you this because then I'm going to take you on a walk and I want you to know where you're going. This is what the site looks like. Right out here. Oh, and the park itself is much bigger than this. It's a huge archaeological park. This part's called the Central Group. And way out here, probably about over here on the screen, is a residential district. And then away up here is another residential district. And away up here, there's a quarry where the stone came from. I want to read you from this book, which is Copan Yesterday and Today. This was written by Bill Fash and the Honduran archaeologist that works with him. And at this little site, there is a very interesting watchman. I have no idea how old he is. He's one of those ageless-looking people. And one day, I just decided I wanted to stay after they closed the park. And why did I want to do that? There's a spiritual quality to that place, and I thought, I would like to be here when there's nobody else here and just sit and think. So I asked this man, I said, would it be possible for me to stay after closing hours? You're supposed to close at 5 o'clock. And the reason I'm telling you this is that he is quoted in this little book. And he said, yes, I could stay. Mm-hmm. And you can stay as long as you want, he said, and I will be here. Well, it was just real fine for about 45 minutes, and then it began to get kind of spooky. You know how it is when the shadows fall, and here are all these things around here, and no other people, and a little deer came down out of the woods, and they're eating in the, you know, on the grand plaza, and that's terrific, but I just finally decided, I think I want to get out of here. And so, I was way over here, you see. Because this is the temple we were working on. And I was way over here, so I had quite a long way to go. And the trees are huge, you know, and I'm walking along here, wanting to get out now, you see. I came up and I came over here, and he's waiting for me, you see, and he said, I thought you'd be here much sooner. No, it was all right for a long time, but then it kind of got to me. Now, Bill Fash is talking, and then he quotes this same gentleman that I'm telling you about. In a few words, an archaeological park presents a piece of our past, which, when appraised and studied, can help us understand the evolution of our own culture and others throughout the world. As the visitor gains a feeling for the economic, political, and spiritual expressions and other aspects of the ancient Copan culture, he begins to identify himself with its people in their struggle to improve the quality of life in the midst of a great variety of natural phenomena. By nature, humans try to relate the present to the past. An old watchman at the ruins, perhaps because of his admiration, recognized Copan's potential to serve as a spiritual connection with humanity. And this is what he said. And I can just hear him saying it. He was such a tremendous person and so proud of this place because it was his heritage, you see. He was a Maya, and this was a place where his forebears had succeeded. This is imposing. Here the people excelled. This people excelled in art. You can see it in other places, but not the way you see it here. The skill that they had for carving the stone. We today, even if we had special tools, we couldn't make one of those stela. This then gives one a love, a great preference for something like those ruins. A memory has remained there through unknown hands. Every day that love of mine has grown more and more and more. I value those ruins like my own house. And he was just a tremendous person. He walked back to town with me, and my Spanish is not perfect, but he and I communicated fairly well. And he was pleased that I had wanted to stay. He said, the spirits live there. The spirits live there. Now, I want to see if there's something that I left out here about the site that you should know. So maybe I better look at this. Did I tell you we're 2,500 feet above sea level here about? Yeah, that's where we are. It's very hot in midday when you're working, very hot. But in the evening it gets very cool in the area. The village itself is over here, about a mile from here. And if you went and came back at the time that the investigator went and came back, then you got to ride in the Land Rover. But if you wanted to hang around a little while, you had to walk back. Now this is the site. You walk through some trees here and you come into this great plaza. And this is about, I would say 2.5 to 3 acres that we're talking about here. And at one time this plaza was plastered and painted, but now it's grassy. All around the plaza are the remains of, it looks like bleacher seating, except it's with stone, all the way around here. These are stela. You know what a stela are? They're tall stone monuments, and they have configurations on them. The stela here, he was born in the month of Rabbit on the 18th day. His name is 18th Rabbit. I'm going to take you around past these stela and tell you a little bit about them. There's also a platform right here, and this platform was used for ceremonial rites. The rulers of Copan would come out of their... See, this is not a residential area here. This is a ceremonial site. They didn't live here. They lived over here. Remember the place where I showed you? Over here. But they would come over here, and they would take their position up here, and they did self-inflicted bloodletting for their people. They had white paper, and they would run thorns through their tongue and ears and other sensitive parts of the body, and the blood would drop on the white paper, and they'd show it to the people that were seated around here. They were suffering for them. The ruler was suffering for them. He was making a propitiation for the people. So this platform was used for ceremonial rites. This is the ball court. We'll come around here and then we'll look at the ball court. And this is the most famous part right here. There is a hieroglyphic stairway here that has, in 63 steps, has 2,300 different glyphs on it. We can now read the glyphs. Epigraphers have been working on figuring out what these glyphs mean for the last 20 years, and they have got it now. They can read those things just like we read English. Well, the people who first found those pieces all in a pile couldn't read them, so they put the hieroglyphic stairway together the way they thought it should go. And now the message is really funny, I guess. See, you're going to have to take it all apart and put it back together again now that they know what it says. But this is a very famous place. This is where I worked. This is probably one, and back here. We call this place the GOK pile. And that was God only knows. Because there was all kinds of sculpture in there, just scattered, all different kinds. And our job was to sort it out, tag it, and label it. We also worked up in this area. But we were reconstructing this temple. It's called the Temple of Meditation, and you'll see pictures of that. I'll take you around over here, past a great, this is a great, a bank of steps here. It's called Temple 11. And I'm going to take you around here, around back. This is a reviewing stand. And this is the West Plaza. And this is the East Plaza. When we get up here, we're going to look down at this altar, and it shows the different kings that served at Copan as rulers. Then we'll go along up here, and we'll see this temple that we have been working on. And we'll look down this way at this temple. A man named King Magudada built this before he died for his tomb. We'll look at that. We'll look up here. We'll look at this stairway. We'll come around here and we'll watch people work on the GOK pile. And we'll also watch workmen constructing the back of that temple. Okay? So we're going to go on just kind of a circle here, all the way around. And if you want to ask me something, well, you just pitch right in and ask. Ralph, somebody over there. Yeah. Could you get the lights for me? Any questions so far? This is what the land along the road looks like. I took this photo as I walked out to the site. This is the valley. Can you see how fertile it is? They grow tobacco here and corn. And then corn up on the higher hills over there. But this is all agricultural land through here. What you see in the background there are homes of the people. Many of them have still thatch roofs. Along the road out to the side, there is a stela. Now there's your first stela. These stela have numbers. And that number doesn't mean a thing to you. And it doesn't have to mean anything. But this one's called Stela 6. And it's the oldest one. There is a glyph on it that identifies the time as being 687 A.D. Now that means that that fellow's 1,300 years old. When he fell, now the funny part of this is that when the civilization declined, they didn't burn this place, they just drifted back off to their homes. And they left it there and let the jungle take over. And it just grew over the whole thing. And it wasn't until the middle of the 1800s that somebody got interested in this place. And then it wasn't until the late 1800s and early 1900s that they began to work to clear it away. So they picked this fellow up. He was face down. That's why he still looks so good, you see. And he was covered up with earth. There's a closer look at him. As you look at this one, notice that he's standing kind of stiffly. And when you see the others, you're going to notice much more fluid line in the sculptural work. You need to know that this carving was done with stone tools. These people did not have metal tools. Now, none of my old gentlemen is not here. Those are real birds, macaws, and they just lined up like that. I don't know why, but they would just line up like that. Notice that there are military guards here also. This is the entrance to the site. And that one just sat on the fence and looked at me. You hear them in the woods, and it's interesting. They're so strange as compared to our birds. This is a wild pig, and there are wild pigs also in the woods around here. That one was not very wild because he was always just asleep by that stump. So one day when I came to work, I just gave him a little nudge to see if he was living, and he was. This is the path into the plaza, very wooded, and behind this building are whole piles of sculpture that haven't been touched yet. You can see them lying every which way. They all have to be sorted, and they all have to have an identification of place. I don't know whether they'll ever get those all used, all figured out. Behind here you have an unexcavated mound. And I want to tell you about another one like that. One day, Bill wanted to talk to his 120 workmen before he gave us volunteers our job. I'm sure sometimes he wished we'd go away, but we'd given him our money, you see, and so he had to find us something to do. So he said, why don't you just go up there and play on that mound up there for a little while? And while I get these other guys going, and then I'll give you your job to do. So we're crawling around up on this mound, and Ed, the retired Methodist minister, said, say, I think I've found something. And you know how that is. We said, sure you have, Ed. You found something. And we came over there, and there was a little knob sticking out there. And if you had read a lot about Maya, you thought, that looks like a Venus headdress. And so we kind of scratched a few leaves away and we called Bill. Now he got real excited and he went right off to get the foreman, and he came back and he kept us all away, you know, all us novices. He didn't want us to wreck anything. And so they started very carefully scratching that away. And it turned out to be, can you see my fingers? It turned out to be a head about like this. that had fallen directly down from the superstructure that was on top of that mound. And there it was, buried in the earth. Hundreds of people had walked over that mound, and no one had ever seen it. And we thought, sure, they dig it. They did dig it completely out that evening, and the next morning they took us down to look at it. And we said, well, what are you going to do with it? And he said, we're going to cover it back up. He said, we're not scheduled to open this mound this year. We're covering it back up to protect it. But they did record that that's where it was and that there was something there, but they covered it back up, broke our heart. Here we are. This is the first site of the Grand Plaza. Now, I've been here three times, twice as a visitor, once as a worker, and I never got over the awe that I felt as I stood there and I thought of 3,000 years of history. Right in the front there, where you see the pyramid, the squat pyramid that has the stairways going up on four sides, that's that ceremonial platform where the kings and rulers oftentimes demonstrated their love and concern for their people by the giving of their own blood. And those are stela that you see scattered around there. These are two Earth Watch people. The woman in the foreground is a conservator of historic houses in North Carolina. And the man on the left is from Michigan, and he's a commercial artist. These are the stela, and these all represent 18 rabbits. They all date from about 700, between 720 and 740. They're very strange looking things, and they're very intricately carved. They are about, I would say, 10 feet tall. You're going to see a 6-foot woman here, and you'll then realize how tall they really are. The flat things scattered around, there are altars in front of the stela. Now remember where we are. We're just looking at the Grand Plaza. Now we're going to start a little tour around. In the background there, you see the remnants of the bleacher seats. This is stela A, and it probably has the most beautiful carving on it of any of them. There was a little crypt in the front that had offerings, and it has been left open. They were pieces of pottery, shell, and several pieces of jade that were found in there. And what you see in the background is the ceremonial platform. Now you can see these up close. There is something I want you to be sure and see, so I'm going to walk up here and show it to you. Wherever you see a bar like this, that represents 5 years. And wherever you see these little knobs, that's 1 year. Whatever this is, and I can't read this stuff, this represents 5 and 4, 9 years, or 9 of something, perhaps on the calendar. It's strange to think that they have now unraveled this so it can be read, but they found out that there are phonemes in here, sound pieces that you can put together and make full words, like words that we make. We say archaeology, ology meaning the study of, see? And that's the way this works, the two pieces going together. I lost my... This is stela A. Now there are some beautiful carvings on the other side also. There is color left on this. These were painted. Many of them were painted red. There are one or two that have residue of blue paint on them. That curly part that looks like when you make a breakfast roll and you roll it there represents rope. Now keep in mind that these were carved with stone tools. The quarry for this rock or stone is about a mile from the site, and it's andesite. When it's taken from the quarry, it's quite manageable. As it stands and is exposed to the air, it hardens. This young man is cleaning the lichens off them so that it doesn't get destroyed. You see, now they're exposed to sun and rain and heat. when they were toppled over, they were protected. They're thinking about making plaster casts of these and putting these in the museum, which I think would be too bad. It's nice to know that you're looking at the real thing. This is Stela 4, as you can see it. The lady on the right there is Linda Sheely. She's a top, I would say probably one of the best epigraphers in the country or in the world. An epigrapher is someone who works with written language, trying to translate hieroglyphics into the kind of language that we're accustomed to. And she's here on the site. We had the day off, and so she's taking us around to see all of these things. We got 2 days off out of 15. This is an altar that's in front of Stela 4, and that is a rope design. We think that this was used for sacrifice because there is a concave part in the middle, and there are little kind of ditches or ravines that run down the sides so that whatever was up there could spill over the side. These are all part people on our crew. Now Linda is 6 feet tall. And you see how much taller the stela is there. So we're probably looking at 11, 12 feet here. And she's telling us about this particular stela. Tremendous lady. Everybody should know someone like Linda Sheely. This is carved almost in the round. In other words, the carving has almost released the figure from the big block that it once was. You gain ideas about what the people wore. This person, who is 18 Rabbit, is dressed in his ceremonial garb. From his belt, he has pieces of eccentric flint. And I'm going to show you one of them, because they're hard to see. This is his belt up here. This little thing coming down here is a piece of eccentric flint that he would use for self-mutilation. In order to draw his own blood. Just small traces of color here are really from the rock, the andesite. It's a kind of a green when it's taken out of the quarry, and then it weathers in. And you can see that it's being pitted, can't you, by the atmosphere. We're just going on around the Great Plaza. This particular one, if you see it from the other side, looks like it has an elephant's trunk on it. And for a long time, they thought that's what it was. Do you see that little thing coming down there on the right, up at the top? When you see that from the front, it's a very strange looking thing. Once in a while, I put my stuff out there so I'd know I'd been there. That's my pack and bag. And this is a photo that I took that evening when I stayed. You can see how long the shadows are. When this place was first seen, none of these things were visible. They were all flopped down in the jungle covered them. One of the people whose names you may recognize, have you ever heard of John L. Stevens and Frederick Catherwood? One was a lawyer and one was an artist, and they came through here in 1846. And Stevens bought this whole thing for $50. Now, these are bloodletting symbols here. Wherever you see that little circle like that, and you'll see it on a number of them. I've got to watch we'll have to scoot along here. 18 Rabbit again. See his headdress. This is a turtle altar, and there's a simulated pool there. Can you see it encircling the turtle? That's Linda over there pointing something out. You can see the eccentric flint coming down from his belt, falling down there. Certainly had on a fancy costume, didn't he? Mm-hmm. This is the oldest stela on the ground. It's 632 it was carved. And it's not really tipping. I just did a poor job of photography there. Probably the one I liked the best was this one, which was Steal a Deed. And I think you'll see why as we get up close to it. Isn't it beautiful? Very intricately carved. The reason that it is so highly admired is it is one of the few stela in any of the sites that has full figure glyphs. You can see the people in there, can't you? This one down here bowed down with a load, and this one up here. And those can also be read. This altar stands in front of Stela D. And one of the men who worked here in the early 1900s died of malaria, and he's buried in front of this, and it was his request. We're looking now down across the great plaza toward the hieroglyphic stairway, which has a big tarp over the glyph part. I would like to be there sometime when that's off. Can you see the encroaching woods here, though? You see, it's very humid. Very humid, and so the growth is there, just ready to creep up and gobble the whole thing up again. She's explaining to us that those are feathers in a headdress, those little angled things that come down. She's pointing here at a node that sometimes occurs in andesite, and they don't know that it's in there until the carving releases it, and then they have to figure out a design that will incorporate that flaw in the rock into the total figure. A double-headed serpent altar. If you have a good imagination, you can see a head on the right coming out of the mouth of the serpent. Sometimes I see it and sometimes I don't. We're moving toward the ball court. Probably the most beautiful one in Maya land, and I've been to many of the sites, and it is certainly something that lives up to its reputation. The slanting part of the ball court somehow had something to do with the game, the way the game was played. The markers are stone heads, macaw heads. There are temples. There's another side just like that over there. And there are temples on top. And they think that those places were used by the players to store their ceremonial habits on. Sometimes this ball game was played for very high stakes. Sometimes for property. Sometimes the losing captain became a sacrificial victim. So it was highly involved in their religious concepts, this ball game. And this was true all over the Maya world and in the areas north of Maya land.
Is there a hoop there?
Beg pardon?
Is there a hoop to put the ball through?
No. In fact, some of them have hoops and some don't. Mm-hmm. The ball could only be struck with the hips, the knees, or the arm. You couldn't touch it with your hand. They wore padded belts. And the ball was about the size of a softball, and it was made from hard rubber. Columbus took one home to Spain to show. The Maya called it Pocatop. Other people called it something else. We're looking at the ball court now from the opposite direction. There were three ball courts here built, one on top of the other. This happens to be the marker for the one that's down below the one you saw. That's the hieroglyphic stairway under the tarp. And you notice that there's a stela in front of it. There's a banister that goes, very difficult to photograph here because we're under the tarp. The banister goes clear to the top. And you can see the glyphs on the stairway there. Remember I told you now they don't make much sense as a message because they just chucked them together any which way, the first people that worked there. They're going to take that all apart and put it together so it says something. is an altar in front of the hieroglyphic stairway, and a burial was found just behind it. Do you see that little kind of a canopy place over there? They tunneled into this mound and they found out that there are other temples inside of this, and they had just discovered a mural on the inside here, and so they're protecting it there as they tunnel in. You see the little flap over there to the side? It looks kind of round coming down. That's the tunnel hole. And let me tell you, it is hot in that place. And that's where that tomb was found that the National Geographic features. We didn't really work in there. They took us on tours in there. We were working on the sculpture outside. But they wanted us to have a flavor of the tunnel. This is what it looks like inside. And that's down one, between two superimpositions there. And that's Bill on the left, the chief investigator. And those are people in our group. We're coming around the corner now in front of that great big stairway. And there's another stela and altar there. Beautifully carved stela. Now you see what the trees are doing to the mounds. This is the ceiba tree, and the ceiba tree is sacred to the Maya. Down to toward the bottom at the left, you have a crocodile altar. We'll see that up close. The Maya believed that the world floated on top, or was resting on top of a crocodile and floating in the ocean of water. We're walking along behind the pyramid now to get up to where we need to go, past piles of sculpture that are just up there waiting to be sorted. This is the reviewing stand, and there's a torchbearer there. There are three of those there, and you can see there are glyphs on the stairway. Now, I'm going to go up that and walk across the top and look down, and here's an altar that's in the west court. Here is the most famous altar. This is the one that has the kings on it. And I want you to see 18 Rabbit. He's the second one from the left. You should see three bars and three dots there on the glyph that he's sitting on. Do you see them? Show me your hand if you see them. They're right here. I mean, it's worth seeing. Right here. And the three dots. I'll have to zip along here. I'm looking down on the ball court from up where I was, toward the Great Plaza. Now I'm going up behind there to get to our work area. And again, you see the work of the ceiba tree. Venerable old tree. Just down at the base of that tree is a head much like the one we found. They call this the Old Man of Copan. And they think that he just fell straight down, got covered up. And then when they started picking things away, there he was. We're going to work now. And we'll walk up these steps and go around the corner. Now we're looking out over the countryside. Those two curly things that you see are fangs, and we're going through the doorway to the Temple of Meditation. And Bill's telling us all about it. We all thought it was quite an ugly thing, but it's really beautiful when you understand it. That says, no eye passe, you can't go in there. Strange, it's a double-headed serpent with the extremities resting on an Atlantean figure, which is resting on a skull. This is the temple we were working on. Now we're looking straight down toward the king's tomb. Haven't found all his pieces yet. Do you see the face on the right? In profile. Another pile. The Jaguar Stairway. Those are as tall as a man, and where you see the little indentations, those were once filled with obsidian. This is a Venus altar. More mounds getting torn apart. Wherever you see those tags, the volunteers have been working. Way up there was my spot. The workmen pulled the pieces of sculpture out of the mound and we scrubbed them and tagged them.